Without further ado, I would like to introduce to you the speaker for our seminar on war and warfare in the Middle East and North Africa in historical perspective. Our speaker today is Professor Sherman Jackson, who is professor of Arabic and Islamic studies and Islamic law. He actually has a position also at law school and teaches a course there on Islamic law. He will be teaching it next semester, as well as other courses related to Islamic law and Islamic theology. Professor Sherman Jackson obtained his PhD from the University of Pennsylvania, from the Department of Oriental Studies in 1990. Since that time, he has been teaching at various institutions in Bloomington, University of Indiana in Bloomington, until he came to the University of Michigan, to the Department of Near Eastern Studies, and that was in 1997. And he's been teaching and researching with us since that time. Professor Jackson has a very long list of publications and honorary appointments. For instance, he holds an honorary appointment as a Thurnor Professor of Near Eastern Studies, which is an honorary title awarded to the best teachers and researchers on the campus. And Professor Sherman Jackson is one of them, definitely recognized by the university, by the provost's office, and the College of Literature, Science, and the Art. Enumerating his awards and honorary positions on various boards, it will take the rest of the lecture. Therefore, I just will mention the books that he has published. His first book appeared in 1997. It was entitled Islamic Law and the State, The Constitutional Jurisprudence of Shihab ad-Din al-Qarafi. Later in 2002, he published The Boundaries of Theological Tolerance in Islam, Abu Hamid al-Ghazali's Faisal al-Tafrika Bain al-Islam wa Zandaqa. Then he published in 2005 another major monograph, Islam and the Black American, looking toward the Third Resurrection. And his most recent book has just come out fresh from the printing press, Islam and the Problem of Black Suffering, published by Oxford University Press. The topic of the presentation is general today, but Professor Jackson will specify it's about jihad. Welcome, Professor Jackson, to the seminar.
Thank you very much, Professor Kanisha, for that very generous introduction. I was actually sitting there asking myself what would possess me to come before you and give a recorded lecture on jihad. But here I say, what I really want to try to, and that you will take that into consideration as I try to compress what I hope to be some very useful thoughts into that very limited space of time. What I'd like to do is to discuss the issue of jihad in two distinct modern contexts. The first is what I would call the domestic context, that is to say, jihad as it is thought about and engaged in the context of the domestic politics of certain Middle Eastern / Muslim states. So we're dealing with jihad in sort of the domestic context. And that to me in some ways is one of the more interesting contexts because it's one of the contexts in which some of the most interesting developments have taken shape in recent years. From there, depending on how much time we have, we're going to move on to jihad in the more international global context and look at some of the intellectual developments in terms of how jihad is thought about among prominent Muslim jurists, thinkers, and activists in the modern Muslim world. So let me begin with jihad in the sort of domestic context. And I think that one of the reasons that this becomes an important topic is that there is a sense in which modernity in and of itself brings forth a state of mind in which religion and religious fundamentalism are looked upon sort of as almost natural reactions to modernity. That is certainly the case when we think in terms of Protestant Christian fundamentalism. And I think that the tendency is, by analogy, to extend that same sort of mode of analysis to modern Islam. That is to say that Islam, not unlike Protestant Christianity, experiences a certain degree of maladjustment to some of the developments that constitute modernity. And one of the natural reactions in that context is a sort of religious fundamentalism, i.e. Muslim fundamentalism, of which jihad is a leading, if not the leading, constituent. Now, this for me raises a question. And the question is Muslim fundamentalism, and I'm placing fundamentalism between inverted commas for reasons which I hope will become clear in just a bit. But is Muslim fundamentalism an inextricable product of Islam as a religion, or is it a byproduct of modernity as a specific intellectual and most specifically political context? That is to say, is what we generally identify as Muslim fundamentalism a product of certain inherent aspects, certain interpretive dictates of Islam as a religion with which Muslims experience difficulty, or from which Muslims experience difficulty extricating themselves in modern times? Or is it not so much Islam as a religion, but a particular intellectual and, as I said, especially political context that seems to bring about this maladjustment between Islam and the modern world? Now, I'm going to put forth a thesis which, in a sense, will both confirm and challenge some of our most deeply held and least examined presumptions about this topic. And I'm going to say that Islam is, in fact, maladjusted to a particular feature of modernity. And that particular feature is the nation state. It is primarily, if not exclusively, in its effort to come to terms with particular aspects of this maladjustment that produces the phenomenon that we generally recognize as Muslim fundamentalism. Now, let me try and clarify what I mean by that. First, when we think of Muslim fundamentalism, one of the first things we have to do is dispense with the demonstrably false connection between literalism as a mode of scriptural interpretation and Muslim fundamentalism as a mode of collective religiosity. In point of fact, what we generally recognize as Muslim fundamentalism has little to nothing to do with any particular modality of scriptural exegesis. And it is certainly not grounded in any commitment to what we would generally understand to be literalism. In point of fact, Islam, in terms of its religious heritage, never did really produce a literalist canon that constituted a leading mode of scriptural interpretation. This is, I realize this is very counterintuitive, especially given the analog to Christian fundamentalism, in which case literalism was the very foundation of everything that flowed from that. But that is not the case with Islam. In fact, even those groups who have been traditionally recognized as being literalist in Islamic history, I think should not be deemed so. If you look at, for example, the Zahirite movement, or the Zahirite movement, if you spirantize your vowels in Arabic, the Zahirite movement, which is usually translated as the literalist movement, The Vahaites were, in fact, not literalist at all. They presumed that a literal interpretation or a plain sense interpretation was the default mode of interpretation, but they did not deny the possibility of going beyond the literal or plain sense to more figurative or allegorical interpretations. They did not deny that at all. In fact, their chief representative, a Spaniard by the name, well, he's the chief representative of whom we know. His works are the works that are still extant, and they constitute the foundation upon which we base everything that we know about Wahhabism today, basically. At any rate, this Spaniard, a man by the name of Ibn Hazm says explicitly, no one believes that mercy has wings. No one believes that that humility has wings. And this is, therefore, a non-literal figurative interpretation. In fact, even the paragon of sort of strict, again, what we have tended to refer to as sort of strict literalism, the leader of the Hanbalite school, who, yes, Ahmed ibn Hanbal, believed that there were no justifications for interpreting Quranic references to God's hand figuratively. But that is not because he did not recognize figurative interpretation as a mode of interpretation. There are references in the Quran in which Ahmed ibn Hanbal is explicit that these are figurative references. So, for example, in the chapter entitled The Star, that chapter begins by saying, the star, when it descends, Ibn Hanbal says explicitly that this verse means the Quran when it is handed down, and that it does not mean the star literally when it descends. My point here being that scriptural interpretation per se is not the sort of foundation of what we generally come to look upon in the form of Muslim fundamentalism, and it is therefore not primarily scriptural interpretation that promotes these tendencies toward violent attempts to seize power and to establish an Islamic order. That's the first point we want to make. Second, and this is related and hopefully will deliver us into an ability to understand what the true nature of any Muslim fundamentalism actually is that we must appreciate the magnitude of the fundamental difference between the basic presumption underlying the modern nation state and that underlying the pre-modern and what I would call the Muslim state. And here, again, I'm being very deliberate and explicit in not referring to the pre-modern Muslim state as an Islamic state. In point of fact, what I'm going to argue is that the Islamic state is the beginning of the problem, because the Islamic state is essentially a modern nation state in which the attempt is made to Islamicize it. And that brings about a degree of dislocation, as we'll see in just a minute. Now, what are some of these fundamental presumptions underlying the modern nation state? Well, there are many, but I want to focus for our purposes upon two. And the first of these is that the modern nation state assumes a monopoly on law. All law that is to be recognized as law, that is to say, as carrying actionable sanctions, are laws that are both produced and adjudicated by the state. Outside the state, there are no repositories of law. No one can produce laws. There are no repositories for binding legal interpretations of laws. And the state exercises an absolute monopoly in terms of the implementation of the law. So a monopoly on the law is one of the first aspects of the theory underlying the modern nation state. The second is that justice, slash equality in the context of the modern nation state is manifested via a uniform regime of law applied equally to all citizens across the board. That is to say that the state, on the one hand, exercises a monopoly over the law. On the other hand, the state, in an effort to exercise its power justly and equally, erects a single regime of rules and seeks to apply that equally across the board to all citizens without discrimination. Therefore, not only is law the preserve, the exclusive preserve of the state, but the modern state presumes what I would call, and other legal anthropologists have referred to it as well, as legal monism. There is one and one only regime of rules that is applied equally and uniformly across the board. Now, this contrasts in some very meaningful ways with the pre-modern Muslim state. In the pre-modern Muslim state, the state exercised no monopoly on the promulgation of law. In point of fact, Islamic law was seen as standing above the state or outside the state. It was certainly not the product of the state. And in point of fact, to a very appreciable extent, Islamic law developed in conscious opposition to the state. In other words, it was in part an effort to preempt the state from acquiring and exercising a monopoly over the promulgation and the interpretation of law, as a result of which sub-state actors, private citizens, acting on their own, set out to produce interpretations of the Quran and the legacy of the Prophet, and these interpretations succeeded in gaining the assent of the community at large. Again, as part of an effort to keep this business out of the hands of the state. Let me try and give you an example of what I'm, well, demonstrate what I'm talking about here. To this day, in Islamic law, and by the way, my entire presentation here today is based on an examination of Sunni Islam. Shiite Islam has a very different reality. Perhaps we could talk about aspects of that during the question and answer period. But for Sunni Islam, to this day, there are four recognized schools of law. The Hanafi school, the Maliki school, the Shafi'i school, and the Hanbali school. All right? Two things about these schools. All of these schools are founded by sub-state actors, private individuals. Not a single school of law is named after a state official. That's one thing. Two, even as the various and sundry Muslim states came into and out of existence, so you have the Umayyad state that is established. It goes out of existence. It's followed by the Abbasid state. It comes into existence, lasts for some time. It is chopped up into various and sundry sultanates. You get various sultanates. Buwayhid Sultanate, Seljuk Sultanate, Ayyubid Sultanate, Mamluk Sultanate. They come and they go. And these are just a few of them. They come and they go. The history of state formation and the state apparatus is a very bumpy, rocky history. And yet, the four schools of law, throughout all of this tumult, continue to exist and buzz along, almost as if they're unaffected by this. Again, that gives us the extent to which law as an enterprise was seen as being separate from the state apparatus. The jurists wanted to be those who promulgated and interpreted the law, and they wanted to limit the state to a purely executive function, that you will apply the law as we have interpreted it on the basis of the Holy Scriptures, i.e. the Quran and the legacy of the Prophet. Now, in this context, given the very decentralized, sub-state provenance of Islamic law, legal pluralism, that is to say, different regimes of rules applying to different groups in society, was actually the norm. And not only was it the norm, but unlike the situation with the modern nation state, legal pluralism was not looked upon as a threat to state sovereignty at all. And let me just give you a couple of examples of what I'm talking about here. And this actually applied both to Muslim citizens as well as non-Muslim citizens. I'll give you an example of the Muslim citizen. My first book, which Professor Kanish kindly cited, was about a Maliki jurist in Mamluk Egypt in the 13th century. The Maliki school of law was a recognized school of law, but at that particular time it was a minority school. And the majority school, that is the favored school of the Mamluk state, was actually the Shafi'i school. Under the aegis of the Shafi'i school, the Mamluk state sought to impose certain rules and policies that were consistent with the Shafi'i school, but that were inconsistent with the Maliki school. And Shihabuddin al-Qarafi, whom I wrote my first book on, was a Maliki scholar who wrote an entire book decrying this attempt on the part of the Mamluk state to impose Shafi'i rules on him as a Maliki. So, for example, he would say, according to the Shafi'i school, to inaugurate the beginning of the month of Ramadan, in which all Muslims are obliged to fast, assuming you don't have certain excuses, pregnancy, illness, etc., you're traveling. But all Muslims are required to fast. And if you are caught fasting, you could be subject to certain sanctions. Well, according to the Shafi'i school, all that's required to inaugurate the beginning of that month is the testimony of a single witness who testifies that the crescent marking the beginning of the new month has actually been sighted. One individual goes to the Chief Justice and says, I saw the crescent, the month of Ramadan has begun, everyone must fast. According to the Maliki school, however, you needed at least two witnesses because they saw this as being the equivalent of testimony in court, in which case you would have to have corroborating evidence. What al-Qarafi argued is that I don't care what the Chief Justice says, I'm not fasting tomorrow, and no one's going to do anything to me because according to the Maliki school, we require two witnesses. They only have one. And it is my right as a member of the Maliki school to abide by that rule. And it is not the right of the Sultan to fordize the rules of Islamic law, to make them uniform and apply them across the board, even to those with whom that rule or for whom that rule is a violation of their interpretation of the sacred law. All right? Second example, this one involving non-Muslims. There was a question that arose regarding the permissibility of certain institutions, non-Muslim institutions, in Muslim society. Now, this was a Muslim society wherein Muslims were the majority and Muslims were in power. You're talking about a Muslim state. The Sultan is a Muslim, all the ministers are Muslims, the army is Muslim, it's a Muslim state. And there are religious minorities in this state, among them being the Zoroastrian community. Now, the Zoroastrian community presented a particularly acute problem for some Muslim jurists. They had an institution that they called self-marriage, according to which a man could marry his mother, or his sister, or his daughter. Now, personally, when I first read this, I read this in a Muslim book on the rights of minorities under an Islam or under a Muslim state. This is a medieval book. And I read this and I said, wow, this looks a little bit polemical. I mean, marrying their mothers, marrying their daughters. So I went to our colleague, Professor Gernot Winfer, in the Department of Near Eastern Studies, who's an expert on Zoroastrianism. And he smiled at me and he said, not only did the Zoroastrian priests allow this, they actually encouraged it as a means of trying to protect the Zoroastrian community from assimilation into the sea of Islam. Right? So we've established that this was not simply a polemic on this Muslim jurist's part, but this was an actual description of what was going on. And from there, he's asked the question, what do we, as a Muslim state, do about this business? They're marrying their mothers. They're marrying their daughters. What do we do about this? And this individual, and by the way, this is Ibn Qayyim al-Jawziyyah, the star pupil of a man by the name of Ibn Taymiyyah. If any of you who read the New York Times or other news organs may have read him as being credited as sort of the founder of modern Muslim fundamentalism, Ibn Qayyim al-Jawziyyah is his star pupil, and this is what he says. If the Zoroastrian community does not seek adjudication from us, i.e. the Muslim state, Muslim courts, regarding any of the issues relating to their institution of self-marriage, then we do not do anything. That's their business. If, on the other hand, they seek adjudication from us, they come to a Muslim judge, a Muslim court, seeking adjudication with regard to some element in self-marriage, then we adjudicate that case not on the basis of Islamic law, but on the basis of Zoroastrian law. This is Ibn Qayyim al-Jawziyyah. My point being that for the pre-modern Muslim state, that kind of legal pluralism was not perceived to be a threat to state sovereignty. Ibn Qayyim al-Jawziyyah did not see this as being any kind of a violation of the integrity of a normatively functioning Muslim state. Because the Muslim state was a state that acted essentially as bailiff, all right, for the various and sundry regimes of rules that were produced by society as communal constituencies, not as individuals, as communal constituencies at large. Now, in all of this, of course, Islamic law was presumed to be supreme. There's no question about that. But there are three points that I want to make here. One, that Islamic law, as I said, was not monolithic. There were various recognized interpretations of Islamic law. Two, as I said, it was not threatened by the existence of other legal regimes, Christian, Jewish, Zoroastrian. Three, and this is a point that is often not understood in modern times, Islamic law, although it was supreme, was not fully comprehensive. That is to say, there were any number of spheres of activity that could not be adjudicated under pure Islamic law. For example, there are no indices in the Quran that speak to speed limits. There are no statements from the Prophet Muhammad on the basis of which we could develop a healthcare policy or determine what should be required to license medical doctors. All of these things were the domain of state policy. And so what we end up with is this. Law over which the state does not exercise ownership or a monopoly operates side by side with policy over which the state does exercise a monopoly and which the jurists themselves ceded to the state. And what we end up with is therefore the boundaries between law on the one hand and policy on the other always being negotiated over time, with the jurists never being comfortable with wholly ceding law to the state. Right? Now, this that you've now been patient enough to suffer through sets the basis for an understanding of what is going on in modern Islam with regard to what we recognize as Muslim fundamentalism. Because modernity fundamentally alters this paradigm for Muslim polities. From the West, the nation-state structure is adopted by the Muslim world. In this context, law becomes the preserve of the state, and law is made uniform. There is one single expression of the law uniformly applied across the board. Muslim fundamentalism is essentially an effort to Islamicize the nation state. That is to say, to adopt the nation state structure, whereby the state exercises a monopoly over the law, and law is uniform, and simply replace the secular law of that state with Islamic law, but still recognizing the state as the owner of law, and recognizing as well that as state law, there can only be a single regime that is applied uniformly across the board. And so what we end up with is Muslim activists coming to the conclusion that the only way of ensuring that that single code or single regime of rules that is to apply to society is actually Islamic law is to seize control over the state. Whereas in pre-modern times, jurists did not need control over the state in order to protect the sanctity of the law as they understood it. In modern times, because the state exercises a monopoly over the law, and only the laws that the state recognizes as such will be law, the need arises, at least from the perspective of Muslim quote-unquote fundamentalists, to seize power over the state. And that is really what we are looking at when we witness the rise of violent jihadi movements in the modern Muslim world. And we're speaking about the domestic situation in the modern Muslim world. These jihadi movements are not committed to any particular literalistic interpretation of Islamic law. What they are interested in is ensuring that the law that governs the modern nation state in the Muslim world is Islamic law. And this in itself raises any number of problems. And given the limitations of time, when should we?
Well, if you can give 7 to 8 minutes for questions and answers.
And we end at one?
At one.
Whew. All right. Well, put it this way. What would my old friend Al-Qarafi do in a modern Islamic state? The state announces that the beginning of Ramadan, the month of fasting, starts tomorrow. He doesn't agree with that. And not simply him as an individual, but him as a member of an entire corporate unit that has been traditionally recognized as a legitimate expression of Islamic law. In the modern Islamic state, he would have no recourse. Therefore, the modern Islamic state threatens pluralism not only as it relates to non-Muslims, but as it relates to Muslims as well. Clearly, under a modern Islamic state, what do you think will happen if some Zoroastrian comes forth and says, I have a dispute with regard to my marriage to my mother? I mean, how much recognition would that likely gain in a modern Islamic state? Again, pluralism is not a possibility there. But the point that I want to make here is that pluralism is not a possibility, not as a dictate of Islamic law, but as a dictate
of the fundamental theory underlying the modern nation state. And what we have is the mixing of Islamic law with the nation state, producing this, what I would consider to be, in some sense, this sort of monster of the Islamic state, which is to be distinguished from the Muslim state. All right? I don't want to be understood to be one of those who argues against the state being the repository of any religiously or religio-legal authority. I'm not arguing for the complete separation between religion and the state in terms of what is actually implemented, right? But the state exercising a monopoly over both the interpretation and the promulgation and the implementation of the law with no possibilities for legal pluralism, that is the problem that the so-called Islamic State raises. Now, here, I only have very few minutes, and I wanted to just sort of lay out a context within which we may be able to understand some of what's going on, and hopefully can fill some of this in the question and answer period. To be very quick, however, the recent developments in particularly Egypt are moving in the direction of a subtle suspicion on the part of these formerly fundamentalist movements that something is not quite right with their theory. That something is not quite consistent with what they have come to understand to have been the traditional posture of Islam vis-a-vis the state. Now, I want us to recall here that, and assuming that you read the two articles that were handed out, that the Gamal Islamiyah, and by the way, the Gamal Islamiyah, or Jamal Islamiyah, depending on what your Arabic is like, but the Gamal Islamiyah was the largest of the violent jihadi movements that appeared in the Muslim world in the late 1970s and early 80s. They were the largest. We must recall that they, in coalition with other smaller groups, assassinated Anwar Sadat for one primary reason, that Anwar Sadat was not ruling in accordance with Islamic law. That Anwar Sadat, as the head of this modern Muslim nation state, was not holding Islam or Islamic law to be the law of that state. As a result of which, they deemed Anwar Sadat to be an apostate ruler who was subject to the death penalty for apostasy. All right? This is not simply my interpretation. All right? They have stated this explicitly, both before and after they assassinated Sadat. In an interview I read of Karim Zuhdi, oh, it must have been now 2005 or 6. Don't quote me on that date. But it was recently. After he got out of prison, many of them have gotten out of prison now. They did about 25 years, and he got out of prison. And he said, we killed Anwar Sadat because he did not apply Sharia. Right? He was not willing to make Islamic law the law of the state. Now, what they're beginning to come to a suspicion of is that there's something not quite right about this. All right? In the readings, what you'll see is that they begin to understand that the central focus of reform in a Muslim society has always gone not to the state, but to society at large. And what they've come to understand is by overemphasizing the status of the state, they're jeopardizing the welfare of society. So in their efforts to take over the state, you know, to knock off all of the miscreant rulers, this, that, and the other, they're actually jeopardizing the opportunity of bringing about a more Islamic society, as it were. Now, and this has led to a number of attempts on their part to adjust their doctrine all right? So that they can still be seen as being fundamentally committed to establishing an Islamic order, all right? But doing so in a way that does not obligate them to come into these kinds of direct clashes with the modern Egyptian state. All right, and they go through all kinds of rather interesting interpretive calisthenics in order to arrive at that conclusion. And by the way, when I say interpretive calisthenics, that's not a veiled reference to any kind of playing with the law. Anybody who's studied constitutional law in an American law school, which I have, knows that interpretive calisthenics are not unique to these modern Muslim radicals trying to adjust their vision to accommodate a new reality. Most lawyers look upon interpretive calisthenics as legal acumen, I think is what they call it. All right. Very briefly here, though, I think, however, that what these movements have not quite made it to is a recognition that, you see, part of what contributed to their rethinking of their approach was the fact that while in prison, they were permitted to read books and to have teachers who taught them the traditional classical model of Islamic law. All right? They're very explicit about this. The Egyptian government allowed for books to come in. There were any number of Ezhari jurists and scholars who were already themselves imprisoned. And these people got an opportunity to actually read for years, all right, the classical tradition. And they came to understand something's not quite right here. All right? And that was the beginning toward a sort of rethinking of this whole matter. What they have not, I don't think, quite come to terms with is, again, the extent to which the problem really is the theory underlying the modern nation state, and therefore the necessity of promulgating a new theory of state that can, on the one hand, accommodate the specificities of Islam, including its legal pluralism, and yet operate in a way that preserves all of the needed sovereignty of a modern nation state, given all that modern nation states are called upon to do. That is, I think, the next frontier. That is where the real imaginative innovations will come. And I think that in the absence of that, all right, all you'll get is a continual moving around of the furniture, all right? Because you will not be able to get pluralism out of the modern nation state of theory as it exists. Very quickly, 2 minutes, let me move to the international jihad. And I just want to say a few words about this because there are some really interesting and really important developments going on and the discussion and the discourse around a jihad with regard to how the Muslim world relates to the West. Just this past summer, one of the most prominent jurists in the Muslim world, bar none, whether you agree with him or disagree with him on this issue or that issue, in terms of influence, he is one of the most influential jurists in the entire modern Muslim world. Sheikh Yusuf al-Qaradawi produced a new two-volume opus, over 1,400 pages, entitled The Jurisprudence of Jihad. And the main thesis that Sheikh Yusuf puts forth in this book are two main points. One, that jihad is primarily a defensive mechanism, and it is directed only at those who express, directly or indirectly, hostile intentions that threaten the physical integrity of the Muslim community. In other words, difference of religion alone is not a reason to engage in jihad against non-Muslims. It is only non-Muslims who threaten the physical integrity of the Muslim community for whom jihad is justified as a means of beating back that aggression. Right? And he goes through a real, as I said, 1,400 pages to vindicate this argument. And I think, quite frankly, that some of his innovations or some of his insights into legal interpretation in general will be as far-reaching as some of his conclusions about jihad. That's the one thing. The second very important point that Sheikh Yusuf makes is that jihad in the sense of military confrontation is not the most important theater for Muslims to be concerned about in the modern world. What he seems to be saying is that the most that jihad as military confrontation could bring for Muslims is the restoration of political authority. That is, they become the autonomous political determiners of their own destiny. But it cannot restore their cultural and their intellectual authority. That requires a very different kind of activity. And for Sheikh Yusuf, that is the most important theater. So the real jihad for him is cultural and intellectual. And what he argues is that not armies, I mean military armies, but we need armies of poets, of journalists, of editors, of writers, of cultural, of producers of culture and thought, all right, that can return the Muslims' degree of cultural and intellectual authority. Only then will they be able to carve out the kind of dignified existence that they deserve in the modern world. And it is this jihad, for him, that is the most important. This book just came out this past summer. It's being hotly debated as we speak. And I'm sure that it's bound to make a real important impact on the future discourse about jihad and the relationship between the Muslim world and the West. Thank you very much.
I guess we have time for a couple of questions only. Where
is Sheikh Yusuf?
He's in Qatar.
In Qatar?
Yes, he's originally Egyptian, but he hasn't lived in Egypt for many years. And he now lives in Qatar. Yes.
So that in his first rule that that jihad is a defensive method, however, against those who have expressed or implied threats against the Muslim world, mm-hmm. However, isn't that open to interpretation? Isn't an implied threat just open to whatever a cultural leader says is an implied threat? So there's the United States who would never explicitly threaten the Muslim world. People might interpret things that United States actions or words do as implicit threats.
Well, but that's always a possibility. Anytime you have a rule, it's always subject to interpretation. But I think that what Sheikh Yusuf is laying out is the following, that those who express a desire for peace, both in word and deed, all right, have to be accepted at face value. All right? Even the Gamal Islamiyah, these are the people who killed Anwar Sadat, say that, no, America was not the enemy of Islam as a whole. And to the extent that they have become so, Osama bin Laden must bear a lot of the responsibility for that. In point of fact, America often helped Muslims in their struggles with others who threatened the physical integrity of the Muslim community. So the point being that, yes, it's always going to be a matter of interpretation. And that's whether you're Barack Obama or anybody else. Leaders are always going to assess the degree of how much we are threatened by any potential adversary. But what Sheikh Yusuf does, however, is establish the fact that the very fact that they are non-Muslims alone is not a justification for going to jihad. There has to be some manifestation, all right, of a threat to the physical integrity of the Muslim community. And for him, he argues basically that the greatest threat is not going to be the physical threat to the physical integrity. All right, it's going to be the threat that comes in the way of Muslims losing, not exercising any cultural or intellectual authority, as a result of which they themselves will read liberalism or Marxism or whatever it is that comes from the West into their own religious interpretation. You won't need them taking over in order for them to do that.
Okay, I think that our time's up. Many of the students have to go. So you can ask the questions informally of Professor Jackson after the lecture.